Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, June 4th. Today we hear more on the latest on the 30-meter telescope. What's the Mauna Kea Authority doing now that the federal funding for the telescope has been pulled? We check in on the roof repairs at the Hawaii Convention Center. Plus, how's the state doing on its goal to cut emissions in half by 2030? And what happens if the goal isn't met? We meet a California transplant on this week's Manu Minute. And on the long view, we take a look at driverless cars. More and more cities across the globe are testing the new technology out. How best to tweak it? This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. You know, this week we've been getting reaction to the news that the National Science Foundation is scaling back on funding for the 30-meter telescope. We heard from the Mauna's protectors, the Kia'i, as well as Big Island Mayor Kimo Alameda, about the late Friday decision that the NSF decided to fund the giant Gemini telescope in Chile with nothing toward the 30-meter telescope proposed for Mauna Kea. The mayor expressed his concern that the other telescopes in Hawaii, including the Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope and the Keck Observatory, stand to be affected. This morning, we talked to John DeFreese, executive director of the Mauna Kea Oversight Authority. He was on the mountain yesterday and flew into Honolulu today for meetings in advance of the board's monthly meeting set for a week from tomorrow. Here's DeFreese.
The Mauna Kea Authority, when it was formed, it kicked off a five-year transition time period. We are now in the 24th month of that 60-month transition, which means that during this transition period, we are in a joint management function with the University of Hawaii. So while we're in that joint management function, we're having to prepare to take full responsibility of Mauna Kea by June 30 of 2028. So there's a body of work that is really important that we complete to include a new management plan, a new master plan, a new financial plan, all of which, and a new set of administrative rules. And all of that is really time-consuming because it requires community engagement and community feedback. Then in the midst of doing this, we get word of the National Science Foundation cutback, right? So from the authority standpoint, our obligation is to the Mauna in total, which means natural resource management, conservation initiatives, cultural practitioners having access, public safety, and astronomy. Okay, so the body of work that we are mandated to do is still in full motion forward, and now we're having, in the joint management role, having to help assess what the revenue reduction, what the funding reduction is going to do in impacting the daily services that are on Mauna Kea, separate and apart from the research that's being adversely impacted.
You were up on the mountain yesterday talking to people. How do we navigate this?
You know, there's obviously, this produces anxiety. There are reduced budgets, oftentimes lead to reduced job positions and all of that type of thing. But what I would say is this, the federal budget is not going to be finalized until October. If I were to use a sports analogy, this is like entering the fourth inning here. And pro-astronomy supporters are trailing dramatically in this metaphor, okay? But I also know that you've got a congressional delegation, we've got a governor, we've got people who are actually doubling down on their efforts to get this funding restored, notwithstanding Mayor Alameda as well. So pro-astronomy people and supporters, I believe, will double, triple their efforts. Conversely, those who oppose it are also doubling their efforts. Something like this, this type of announcement at this scale is going to be catalytic to everyone that cares about the Mauna. My responsibility at the Mauna Kea Authority is to make sure that we have a process in place that is fair, consistent, transparent, regardless of what your sentiments are relative to the future of astronomy and the care for Mauna Kea. So our work, I won't say it hasn't been interrupted, because it has, but we cannot lose our focus about why the authority was brought about.
You're here in Honolulu today. Who will you be meeting with?
Actually, I'm here to meet with the chairman of our board, John Komeiji, and part of it is to prepare the agenda for next Thursday's board meeting, which has to be publicly posted by this Friday. So whether this was happening at the federal level or not, this would be somewhat routine to our planning efforts in advance of a board meeting.
I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to any of the other telescope people, but you've had your ear to the ground. What's the concern for the research up on the mountain?
Separate and apart from the research, separate apart from the impact on operations, I think I felt for the loss, what sounds like 100% reduction of programs like postdoctoral fellowships. These are the future astronomers, whether it be in Hawaii or any place else in the world. But when you start taking out educational training and advanced degree programs, you're really cutting at the heart of this industry. And I see that as being very problematic.
There are multiple legal challenges and various cases that are being weighed. I don't know, do you see a need to check in with the state attorney general on anything at this point?
That would be the normal course of action. But at the moment, convening with our board is really important. You know, what's interesting about our board is by design, it is extremely diverse. So you have Kia'i on the board, you have an astronomer, higher education's represented, business and finance. And it was designed that way so that to the degree that you can get a 360-degree view on Mauna Kea and its future, that's how the board was designed. So getting behind the boardroom table and being able to explore this with the board is of immediate interest to me. While I can talk to them individually, I think it's really important that they engage as a full body, because they've been diligent in their efforts long before I got to the authority a year ago. Most of them have been at the boardroom table for the last 2 years. And what's happening now at the federal level is having implications on kind of the work of the authority. And so I'm immediately interested in getting together with the board and then subsequently with legal to get some background on it. I think recently I've heard Governor Green reemphasize his support and his belief that the congressional delegation will continue to advocate on behalf of astronomy in Hawaii. And frankly, Act 255, the enabling legislation that created the Mauna Kea Authority, mandates that astronomy is part of state policy and needs to be advocated and advanced as well.
Anybody else that you plan to meet with prior to this meeting next week?
Yes, immediately getting together with the leadership of the Center for Mauna Kea Stewardship, which is the University of Hawaii. It's going to affect immediate operations and the need for scenario planning about what happens in October when the final federal budget comes together. We can't be surprised by the fact that these cuts may survive all the way through, and we're going to be faced with some immediate operational decisions. So my immediate attention is going to be focused locally on the mountain, and I'm grateful to have a board that can focus externally in areas such as Washington, D.C. So my immediate attention is focused on the mountain itself.
When you say operational, are you talking about state funds or money through the University of Hawaii?
There's a portion of the operations there that are shared costs by the observatories that are up there. And given the extent of the current proposed budget reductions, that will have an impact inevitably on their portion or their contribution that they make to sustain operations on the mountain. So the state is subsidizing part of that, but the existing observatories have a prorated share in making sure that the roads are safe, the public's safe, programs in specific areas of conservation and cultural practices are moving forward. And should these budget cuts survive the way they've been proposed, we'll be faced with program cutbacks and without sacrificing public safety, frankly.
There is that legal challenge that was filed by the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. Will the agenda include an update on that?
Not on this month's agenda, but it will appear on one of our board meetings this summer.
And that was John DeFreese, Executive Director of the Mauna Kea Oversight Authority, talking to us this morning. In a statement issued by the Keck Observatory, it noted that it stands to lose significant funding from both the National Science Foundation and NASA. It goes on to say in a statement, our partnership with NASA has enabled a number of NASA breakthrough missions and has made Keck Observatory's archive data available to the world. On average, one scientific paper a day for the past 20 years has been published using Keck Observatory data. Our partnership with NSF has enabled Keck Observatory and other observatories to build instrumentation, keeping Hawaii's astronomy at the cutting edge of discovery, end quote. The statement emphasizes that it is working with our congressional delegation to help pass a budget that will maintain world-leading astronomy here in the islands. We did also reach out to the Solar Telescope at Haleakala on Maui, but have yet to hear back.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
A proposal to cut federal funding to public media has made it to Congress. If passed, these cuts would impact HPR's ability to serve Hawaii and devastate smaller rural stations across the country. Stand up for HPR and public media. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/protect.
Support for HPR comes from the Hawaiian Humane Society, dedicated to the humane treatment of all animals, accepting pet photos for its 2026 Pets in Paradise calendar contest through June 30th at hawaiianhumane.org.
You know, the governor just signed a bill into law that stands to change the way we manage tourism in this town. It makes the Hawaii Tourism Authority an advisory board again, following criticism about governance and oversight. One issue that is high on the priority list is the contract for the Hawaii Convention Center repairs. This morning, we talked to Keith Regan, the state comptroller at the Department of Accounting and General Services, or DAGS, as it's also known. He's been tasked with taking over the project of fixing a leaky roof at the Hawaii Convention Center. Regan has been tasked with taking over the project of fixing a leaky roof at the Hawaii Convention Center, and he may be well positioned to do that, given that he previously served at HTA before taking on the job as director at DAGS.
We were asked to step in and support the Hawaii Tourism Authority and DBED, as well as the Convention Center, when it became apparent that there was a need for some additional support on this particular project. And given some of our background, my background in particular, having worked for the Hawaii Tourism Authority for many years and having been involved in some of the CIP work in supporting those activities within the center, the reason why they reached out was because there was some familiarity with the Convention Center. Plus, this is what we do at DAGS. We handle large CIP projects. We build buildings. We handle complex projects such as this rooftop project. And we have a team of people within our operation that have that experience and that knowledge and that background. And so I think the natural direction for HTA, DBED, others, HTA board as an example as well, was to reach out to us directly and see if we were able to step in and provide some additional guidance and support on this project.
Well, what's the snapshot right now? Mm-hmm. Because I think the concern is that the repairs were going to be delayed.
Mm-hmm. Right now, we're reviewing the documents that have been created There were over, I think, 34 documents that were part of this RFP for the rooftop project, and then some additional contract documents that they were working on prior to our stepping in to help. We have to spend some time going through those. We literally just sat down with the HTA last week and the convention center and their consultants to go over preliminary topics related to the rooftop project. It's probably going to take us a couple of weeks to go through those 38 actually documents that are pretty complex. We have to make sure that as we move forward in this project that we do it right. Not to say that it wasn't. It's just that we need to make sure that it aligns with the way that DAGS typically handles our large state CIP projects. There's a lot of I's that need to be dotted, a lot of T's that need to be crossed, and we just want to make sure that we don't miss anything. We're asking for a couple of weeks to review these documents. During that time, we'll be going back and forth with the HTA and with the Convention Center. We will have some questions about what we are looking at within those documents, and hopefully it won't delay the project by too much. I'll knock on a little wood here just because I don't want to say something that ends up not being accurate, but it is a complex project, and it's a critical project for the state. We recognize that. I recognize that with my background, having been there for, like I said, for many years, that getting this convention center up and running and not leaking into these ballrooms is essential and critical for our economy.
I think we all recognize that, you know, as they say, you don't want to botchy the project.
Right.
But I'm not sure how the whole governance thing makes it more of a sticky problem, you know, because, you know, we often hear that the state procurement law is a bit cumbersome and there's so many hoops to go through and you got to make sure that everything's done properly because
right.
you don't want a challenge. You don't want something to go awry and delay right. the project even more.
Yeah, that's part of this due diligence, right, that we're this phase that we're in right now, reviewing the documents and making sure that we've really dotted our I's and crossed our T's to ensure that we're not missing something. It's critical because we want to make sure that the project is not delayed. If we miss something, that might lead to a delay. And, you know, in order for us to prevent that from happening sometime as we go down this path, we've got to spend that time up front to just make sure that we're not missing anything. So it does take some time. And the state procurement process is designed in a way to ensure that we're protecting taxpayer dollars as well.
In talking with Terry Orton with the Convention Center, I mean, I know at the time we chatted, bills were still in play and, you know, the lawmakers were set to release the money or at least appropriate the money. Mm-hmm. So we have all that money already in place?
That's my understanding. I believe all the funding is secured, so that's not an issue at this point. Really, it is just making sure that the bid documents are complete and that we have reviewed all of the documents to ensure that the project can move forward as quickly as possible.
What's the time frame? What have you been told about when it has to be completed in order to honor the commitments that we might have with these conventioneers that may have already worked out the details about their conventions and their meetings here?
Yeah, my understanding is that Terry has set aside some very specific dates in order to allow for the work to move forward. I believe it's going to be approximately a two-year process. This is a huge undertaking, right? This is not something that is going to be done in a month or two. It's going to require extensive work on the rooftop, essentially removing the materials, getting down to the base pan that's there, fixing whatever rotten material might be underneath there that is causing some of the leaking, and then putting back, you know, all the waterproofing material and the concrete and the pavers and everything else. And so this is probably a two-year project is what we're looking at. And we are aligned with what the Convention Center and the HTA and DBED have proposed as it relates to the closure of the center, which I believe it was 2 years. I don't have the specific dates in front of me, but I just do recall that time frame was approximately 2 years.
And refresh our memory, though. I mean, was the original plan to award this contract and have work start this year in 2025?
I believe so. I mean, in looking at the documents, we can see that the time frame for us to at least receive bids at this point in time was June 20th. So bids are due on June 20th at this point. We're probably going to have to extend that a little bit. But in terms of the overall closure for the facility, I think we're still within the calendar time frame that's been established, even if we need a little bit more time to review the documents and extend the due date for the bid.
You know, I'm dating myself, but I recall when the idea for a convention center was first proposed, there was some hand-wringing about whether this facility was going to compete with others in Honolulu for business. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, they held out, oh, no, no, we're trying to attract new convention business, mm-hmm. not so much the small kind, you know, local right. events. And yet, I know we've come off an incredible year where that is what has saved, I think, the bottom line for the convention center. Mm-hmm. You know, I noticed that we even had some graduations this year, mm-hmm. you know, besides the cultural festivals, right? The Okinawan Festival, that kind of thing.
Right.
How do you, you know, sort that out?
Yeah, I can't really speak to that. I mean, that's sort of not in my wheelhouse in terms of from a DAG standpoint. But I think what has been proven, though, is that the facility itself is much more than just a convention center in the pure sense where only outside events are being brought in. I mean, I think it has proven itself to be a multi-use facility, including being used during crisis. We saw that during hurricane season. That facility has been stood up as a shelter in the past, including some tremendous support for COVID when we had to shut down and move the entire unemployment insurance operation over from DLIR and stand that massive operation up in the convention center. So I think the facility itself has really proven that it is much more than just a convention center. It has a lot more utility, including supporting a lot of these local events that are happening. There's basketball, there's volleyball, there's, you know, pickleball events that are happening there. And I don't know where else you could do those kind of things in a environmentally controlled and location facility like that.
Yeah, well, you know, in a way, with the shutdown of the concert hall, mm-hmm. right? I mean, at least it was another venue mm-hmm. for events.
Yeah.
But yeah, anything else that you think would be important to underscore? You know, I don't know, the price tag. It was $60 million that we were getting from the legislature, correct, initially?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, at this point in time, we do anticipate that the project should be in about that range, approximately $55 to $60 million. Only time will tell. When we get the bids in, then we'll know for sure in terms of whether or not the estimates were accurate. And there's been multiple estimates, right, that have been performed, not by DAGS and not by HTA or HCC, but by a third party to ensure that, you know, we're on target in terms of the actual price or the cost, right, to the state for this work.
And the big mystery question is whether tariffs may impact
yeah.
any of the materials.
And I think it's certainly... That's definitely something that we're concerned about. And there's a lot of material in this project that may be subject to tariffs. And we keep hearing sort of this back and forth discussion from Washington about steel and aluminum, right? And these 50% tariffs, and now they're on and now they're off, or now they're 20% or whatever they may be. It is definitely causing some concern within the project team.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll definitely be keeping an eye on this. But Keith Regan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
That was Keith Regan, the State Comptroller at the Department of Accounting and General Services, giving us an update on repairs to the leaking roof at the Hawaii Convention Center. This is a conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today's backyard quiz, test your geology knowledge. Many might know that the Pacific region is home to mountains and volcanoes at the Earth's surface. But did you know that there's a massive pile of hot rock called a super plume stretching for thousands of miles underneath the Pacific region? The Pacific Superplume is nearly 2,000 miles across and lays beneath four hotspots on Earth. And scientists aren't quite sure why this superplume exists, but some believe it helped to create the active underwater hotspot that formed the Hawaiian Islands. The formal name for the Pacific Superplume is a large low shear velocity province, but we like the nickname for this superplume more. Scientists refer to it as Jason. And for today's backyard quiz, we want to know, why is the Pacific Superplume underneath Hawaii named Jason? Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
HPR reporter Savannah Herrmann-Pote has been doing a number of stories recently focused on Hawaii's green energy goals. And given the White House position on climate funding, the goals take on added dimension. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, I mean, we've been hearing a lot about how we will probably fall short of our goals.
Yeah, so Hawaii has a range of climate policies that are all the more important during this federal rollback, I'm hearing from many experts. One that I've been focusing on is this goal to slash greenhouse gas emissions in half compared to 2005 levels by 2030. So we have 5 years to do it. But multiple state agencies have come out with modeling that says we are going to fall short. And I'm curious about what this means, because this isn't just an aspirational goal. This is a law. It's in our statute. So what are the consequences if the state misses that target and essentially is breaking the law? And so I brought this question to Richard Walsgrove, who heads the environmental law program at UH's law school. And he said one way to view it is that nothing happens in the traditional sense of how we would think of consequences when we break the law. Like, no state officials are going to go to jail. No one is going to be penalized with fines. But there are enforcement mechanisms in place that could be activated, not just in 2030, but now. So some of that power lies with our governor.
Every agency's sources of funding, allocations of money from the legislature, are also at risk if they do not properly account for carbon pollution in decision making. And that can happen via executive order. The governor can actually, it is authorized in our statutes to withhold funds from agencies if they are not abiding by these carbon pollution statutes.
But there's also power that lies with private citizens. So these laws are very broad. According to the statute, every agency should be considering the emissions impacts of every decision that they make.
So the enforcement mechanism, particularly for a private citizen like that, really comes down to one provision in these laws that requires all state agencies to take into account the impact of their decisions, their strategies, their plans on whether or not the state can meet these targets. And so what a citizen could do is a citizen could point out anywhere in the breadth of state government that these targets aren't being appropriately, you know, sort of chased. They could seek to invalidate agency decisions on that basis.
Yeah, but it's not that simple, though, right? Because given the climate that we're in, it could make things a lot more difficult for the state.
Certainly it could when we look at federal action. And I kind of expected this story to be a little bit more of a cynical one, but there was a lot of encouragement from Richard Walsgrove saying, hey, citizens do have a chance to hold their state government accountable based on the way Hawaii specifically has written its laws. Not every state has this opportunity for citizens to say, okay, we understand that the Department of Transportation wants to build a new parking lot. If a citizen raised a question like, will that parking lot have electric vehicle chargers? If not, that decision could become suspect. And if an agency doesn't abide by a citizen's petition, then a citizen could take that agency to court. That's a lot of power in the people's hands.
Yeah, and have there been any examples of someone taking this to court?
So not over missing the 2030 target, but the closest analogous case that Richard Walsgrove provided as an example was in 2017, the private advocacy group Life of the Land filed a lawsuit against the Public Utilities Commission for approving the operations of the biomass plant Huhonua had wanted for Hawaii Island. And they say that the Public Utilities Commission didn't adequately factor in the plant's air pollution. And the Public Utilities Commission ultimately reversed its decision, and after a really protracted legal battle, that was upheld by the Hawaii Supreme Court as well. So Walsgrove says it is possible we're going to see more lawsuits trying to sort through all of this as we near our 2030 target. And it's not just us that's dealing with this. So across the country, these legal questions around climate goals are really starting to come to a head. Hawaii is one of 24 states, as well as the District of Columbia, that has adopted some kind of emission reductions target. And as the clock ticks down on these climate deadlines, Hawaii isn't the only state that may fall short, may miss the mark. And interestingly, Vermont state government is currently embroiled in a lawsuit as to whether it missed a target set for this year, 2025. So Patrick Parenteau is a professor emeritus at the Vermont Law School, and he kind of got me up to speed on what's happening there.
The lawsuit alleges that Vermont has indeed missed the first 2025 deadline for reduction, whereas the Agency of Natural Resources insists that we have not missed it. And it turns on the model that the ANR is using to measure, you know, the greenhouse gas inventory of emissions. So you have this kind of hyper-technical argument about whether the model is using the right inputs, making the right assumptions, etc. And that's what the legal dispute is about. It has spilled over into the political realm.
So the group, the Conservation Law Foundation, was able to bring this lawsuit against Vermont because of one specific provision in their reduction mandate statutes called a citizen suit provision. And that's what gives private citizens and groups the standing to sue the government. However, as Patrick Parenteau alluded to, there's been this political backlash against that. And there was a move by Vermont's legislature to repeal that provision this year. And Parenteau says without it, their emissions reduction laws just won't have the same teeth. It would be much harder to get an independent judgment on a question about whether Vermont is off track on its goals. And answer to that question matters not just to Vermont, but to all of the states that are working to reduce their emissions, including Hawaii, because of just what you've been talking about, Catherine. It's really a state-led movement to reduce carbon emissions right now. And the emissions of Hawaii and Vermont are small compared to the rest of the U.S. and the world, but Walsgrove really believes that their efforts still matter as a part of this movement to address climate change in light of the Trump administration's federal rollback on climate initiatives.
The problem in the United States right now is there is no federal backstop. We know that the federal government has abrogated for the time being its responsibility on greenhouse gas emissions because we have a climate denier in the Oval Office. And so it's really important that these states continue to carry forward the momentum. And if one state chooses to change things, it's probably not a big deal. But if you start to see 10 or 15 states change their policies, I think that could be a significant drag on Hawaii's efforts to be part of the solution.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
Yeah, and another thing that's tied into this too is a lot of the progress the state needs to make it to hit these goals requires not just federal support in an abstract sense, but specific federal funding or concrete federal support. And we saw another lawsuit that the state settled with a group of youth plaintiffs last year, the Navahine settlement, right? And that was where a group of young people went to the Department of Transportation and said, hey, you're not doing enough to reduce carbon emissions from the transportation sector. And in that settlement, in the last year, the Department of Transportation has been working with youth plaintiffs to come up with a plan that will reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. And they plan to have that available for the public to view this month. However, that plan relies on federal support. So one of the plaintiffs in that Navajine lawsuit has now joined a new lawsuit where 22 young people from across the country are suing Trump over his executive orders that promote fossil fuels, saying, and they're saying essentially, if we don't have federal backing, all the work that we put into that first lawsuit to get the state to look at its transportation strategies isn't going to matter because we won't have the resources we need to implement these strategies.
Yeah, one of many lawsuits pending against the Trump administration. Yeah, so we'll have to see where this goes. But yeah, you know, you do want to see some teeth to make sure that the law gets followed. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We have been hearing from HPR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pope. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
This Saturday, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Honolulu Jazz Quartet. Enjoy live performances with HPR every Saturday in June. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Today on The Daily, the story of Operation Spider's Web, the audacious sneak attack by Ukraine that destroyed billions of dollars worth of Russian warplanes with drones that cost as little as $600, and why the attack is already being seen as a defining moment in the evolution of modern warfare. I'm Natalie Kitroweff. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, and it's time for this week's Manu Minute. Today we feature a bird from the Golden State. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the California quail.
California quail are native to the west coast of North America and were first introduced to Hawaii way back in 1818 as a gift from a ship captain to King Kamehameha I. By the end of the 1800s, quail had expanded and become common across all the main Hawaiian islands. Like many other game bird introductions to Hawaii, their numbers declined for a variety of reasons, including hunting, predators, particularly mongoose, and possibly disease, to the point where they're now rare on all islands except for the Big Island, where they're still fairly common. California quail are only about 10 inches long from the tip of their tail to their bill, and are known for their distinct, curled black topknot on their head that's made up of six feathers that droop forward. The males are particularly striking, with a bluish-gray breast and back, with white streaks and chestnut-colored cap on their head. California quail are mostly found in higher-elevation grasslands and woodlands on Mauna Kea and Mauna Loa, where they feed on a variety of seeds of both native and introduced plant species, also leaves and insects. They lay about 12 to 16 eggs in a nest, and similar to chickens, their young are known as precocial, meaning the babies are able to follow their parents and forage for food within minutes after hatching. One way to find California quail is by their call, which sounds a bit like Chicago, Chicago. You can typically find quail in big flocks, known as coveys, on the ground. But if they're startled, they'll loudly burst into flight all at once, making them very popular with hunters. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges. Learn more about supporting these habitats of endangered Hawaiian birds at friendsofoahunwr.org.
Now it's time to dig deep for the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we gave you a crash course in plate tectonics, the study of massive, slow-moving plates that make up the Earth's crust, and to explain how continents form. A massive block of rock near the Earth's mantle called a superplume sits under the Pacific. Its technical name is a mouthful, so scientists usually just call it Jason. And we asked you why. Well, Jason's namesake was an acclaimed geologist from Savannah, Georgia. He did most of his work at Princeton University, including being the first to identify that our planet's surface is broken into about 20 tectonic plates. When these plates interact, they can create earthquakes, mountains, and even volcanoes, like the ones that form the Hawaiian Islands. And this plate tectonic scientist's name was W. Jason Morgan. And congrats to Brendan from Palolo. He knew the answer because he says he's a scientist at Hawaii Pacific University. Thanks so much, Brendan, for calling and playing our game. But that's our quiz. And if you have an idea for one, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Today in the Long View, our contributing editor, Neil Milner, wanted to talk about driverless cars, which I'm glad about because I had an experience that I can share. How are you today?
I'm good. Your experience wasn't so good, but it's kind of typical about what people are afraid of, right? So what I'm going to talk about is there's some really new research about autonomous vehicles that really changes a perception about how you should look at them. You may not be convinced that you want to ride in one, but let's go through the motions. So autonomous, you know, we call them driverless cars, autonomous vehicles, the usual story goes like this. People who are worried about them or opponents of them say, we don't trust them because they're not human, that we don't know what they are, but they're not human. The proponents of them, including the people, the companies that have been involved, say, look at the statistics. If you look at the statistics, there are many fewer accidents. The rate is much fewer with driverless cars than it is with humans. And so when you do the argument around that ground, it's a fairly simple argument. One side says, well, they're not human. And the other side says, well, that's precisely what makes them better. Because, you know, the AVs don't get drunk, they don't get emotional, they don't fall asleep at the wheel, they don't get angry, they don't get distracted, and nobody is texting from the driver's seat.
Right, they don't have that human error,
they don't
however.
Have human error. Yes, but here's the thing. This new research, which is pretty complicated to read, it's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, looks at it in a different sort of way. They say, you know what? That debate is too simple. What it means to be human is much more complicated than that. And what it means to be human in everyday life includes a sense of social ethics, they call it. And I'll give you an example in a second. So they say, look, if you're just going to think about autonomous vehicles with a fairly simple program, that one way of looking at it is that you look out for yourself, right? Another is that it's between you and that thing in front of you. But they say in human life, we do something more than that, even if we're not conscious of it. They talk about a trolley problem. First of all, trolley problem is that classical problem of you have control over some kind of lever. And on one part of the trolley tracks are five people on the tracks that are going to get hit unless you throw the lever. But on the track that it'll go to, if you throw that lever, it's going to kill somebody else. And that's kind of a classic problem in philosophy. And what this is about is that, without answering which one you do, but they say, look, social ethics, real life human social ethics, involves thinking not just about what's in front of you. Let's say you're driving. Not just what's in front of you, but also yourself and also surroundings. Are there other pedestrians around? What's around there? You do this very quickly, and you do it what we would call self-consciously. So what these data scientists did was to try to build a model that makes driverless cars more human. More human, that is, by including more complexity into what the driverless car does. If you just think about it in terms of that old argument, safe, not safe, I don't trust it because there's nobody in there, you miss what they're trying to do here. I'm not saying you're going to be convinced what they're trying to do, but I'll present some evidence in a second. But what they do then is to say, if you develop a sense of social ethics, where essentially the, quote, driver is thinking about a variety of ethical, you know, what's right, what's wrong, you have dilemmas, you have multiple meanings at the same time, that's much more like what we're like, not what we think an autonomous vehicle is like, or not what lots of people think autonomous vehicles are like, because in many ways they really are like that because they don't have this advanced information. So they build this program. They build this data set. That's where it gets complicated. A lot of it has to do with neuroscience and philosophy. So you develop a set of instructions based on those kinds of things. The neuroscience has a lot to do with what we've learned about cognitive maps in our heads over the years. And one of the things we learned in rat research, turns out when you do research on rats, their cognitive map is a very important role in deciding what to do, deciding what direction to go. And just with a brief advertisement here, when my son wrote a book about GPS, he looked at this rat research because one of the things it suggests that if you constantly go down one pattern in a maze and you don't have to look for anything else, your brain changes. You become more narrow. The analogy
you're hardwired,
is
hardwired, right?
Yeah. The analogy is if you're not using a map and you just lose the instructions, you don't learn what's around you. So anyway, so they discovered over time that the cognitive map is really very important in human dimensions. Okay. So it turns out when you build this in, and they ran a lot of empirical tests on this, it turns out that incorporating that kind of information reduces accidents significantly. I wouldn't say it's definitive yet, but it does suggest that when you make it more human, you're also making it more complex. And when people hear complexity in science, that makes them frightened, right? Because they worry that it's not so definitive anymore. But it's an interesting, it's interesting on two levels. One, what it says about the cars itself. But the other about what it says about being human and the ability to build, what do we want to call it, philosophical and neurological data, all of which we carry in our heads. I don't mean that we all read Plato, but, you know, ethical data, what's the right thing to do here? And when you incorporate that into some kind of model for the, that would be, that the data on the autonomous vehicle would be on, turns out that being more human that way seems to make a positive difference.
Well, I know that the technology is rolling out in a number of cities. My experience in San Francisco was I was crossing.
I'm laughing because you told me before.
Yes, yeah. A crosswalk, and I look up, and this car is going very fast. And I'm thinking, holy cow, there's nobody in that car. I'm not going to wait to find out if he's going to hit me. I don't want to become a statistic.
Yes.
And it didn't just happen once in the city. It happened twice in two different neighborhoods, and I was a bit traumatized. And then I saw in the news, like the next day, that a driverless car had hit a fire engine. And at that point, the city ordered the company to take out half of its cars off the street because it was glitchy.
Well, the good news is that it was probably a Jaguar that almost hit you, because I'm pretty sure, based on what a friend of mine who just took one told me, all of the driverless cars in San Francisco are Jaguars. If you have certain stereotypes about who can afford to live in San Francisco, no big shock. But the other part then is to figure out what the problem was. Was it because it's not human and that you got some doofus autonomous car doing your driving, or can you make the program better so that's less likely to happen? It's almost like the COVID vaccine. Some people wouldn't care how good you made it. But there's also the possibility that making it better involves something that most of us don't think about, which is incorporating these kinds of ethics, incorporating ideas that are based on that trolley situation. What do you do when you have two situations where there's going to be bad consequences? How do you pick?
Well, you want them to tweak the software to make sure it does what it's supposed to do and not run into the fire engine.
No, the important thing, first of all, is what you build into the software here.
Yeah, so you brave enough to go jump in when you think?
Yeah, because I'll drive in. I may be in the car that almost hit you. You're the pedestrian. No, I have my. It would seem to me to be odd and a little disorienting at first. It's not that I talk to the taxi driver very much, but
that's one of my favorite things to do on trips.
Well, that's because that's how you journalists work. Yes. You ask the taxi driver who's going to win the election, and that becomes your lead story. No, but I would do it. I would do it just to see what it's like. After driving in San Francisco on and off for many years, that can't be any worse than driving there.
Okay. All right. Well, let me know how it goes, okay?
if I live to tell about it, yeah. But I hope to die an ethical death.
Okay, yeah. There you go. We've been hearing from our contributing editor, Neil Milner. We'll have links to the articles that he's referenced on our website later today. Okay, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we hope to get the latest on the elections in South Korea. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on our website or on Spotify and Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.